You're listening to a curated podcast from the Beyond Infinity radio program, broadcast live on Tuesdays from 11 a.m. from our Mornington studios in Victoria, Australia. Listen live on 98.7 or 98.3 FM or stream live from rppfm.com.au. Presented by me, Piers Cunningham.
And me, John Young.
Into our science and technology news. The first science results have been presented from the Juno mission. That's the big solar-powered craft that's in orbit around Jupiter. About every 50 days, it dips down very close to the cloud tops of Jupiter, in between the radiation belts, and studies the atmosphere. And it actually has a microwave instrument on board, which allows it to peer down through the clouds and give you an idea of what's below the clouds. They've found that the magnetic field of Juno is about 10 times stronger than expected. And this suggests that and this is really quite bizarre, that the hydrogen metallic core that is creating that magnetic field could be as large as half the radius of the planet, which makes it enormous, because Jupiter is vast. I mean, the Great Red Spot, you could fit more than one planet Earth just into that Great Red Spot. So it gives you an idea of how big it is. I think it's the second only to the Sun in terms of magnetic field within our solar system. If you could see the space that is influenced by the magnetic field, if you could actually see it with the human eye, it would be bigger than the Moon in our night sky.
Oh,
if
right.
You could look up and see where Jupiter is. So the magnetic field extends much, much brighter and much broader than the actual planet itself. We will post links to, in fact, I put one up on Twitter on our website, beyondinfinity.com.au, a link to teleconference that they did. You can actually look at it's on YouTube and has a series of images which are referred to during the teleconference. So not quite as good as seeing the actual speakers, but you hear them and they go through, and it's a bunch of project scientists.
I just noticed on the report you're looking at, it's the magnetic field is around about 7.7 Gauss, which is 10 times stronger than the strongest magnetic field on Earth.
Very, very powerful magnetic field. And that's why they've been very careful in the way that the orbit is constructed, and the design of the orbit is there to minimize exposure to that. And in fact, the electronics on board the spacecraft are inside a special sort of, you know,
gold and aluminium or something?
Protected box, which is there to protect those electronics, because without that, they'd be fried by the radiation. This has always been a consideration with missions out at Jupiter. There's very, very powerful radiation, so that needs to be protected against, particularly when you're diving down really close to the cloud tops. In fact, the next close orbit, which is happening, I think it's July the 11th, there's a flyby which will be directly over. They're aiming to fly directly over the Great Red Spot. So that's that famous storm in the equatorial region of the planet. So not just the poles, which they've been studying in earlier orbits. They're going to swoop down and have a look at the Great Red Spot and point those atmosphere penetrating instruments that they've got on board to give them an idea. Because even though there are some amazing photos, which are kind of being outsourced, so there's a sort of outreach, public outreach program with the images that are being taken. So a lot of the images you actually see on the Juno website are done by members of the public who get the data, download it, then enhance it and play around with it, stitch images together, that sort of stuff. But the real focus of the mission is the other scientific instruments, which are doing things like actually penetrating down into the planet. So the Galileo mission in the 90s and early 2000s looked at the whole system, in particular the moons. The Juno mission is looking particularly at the planet itself, trying to understand its magnetic field, understand the auroras with instruments that are designed to get below the clouds. I think they can look down to about 300 kilometres deep down into the atmosphere. I mean, the atmosphere goes for tens of thousands of kilometres down. They're at least getting to look below, and they're finding things which they weren't expecting. They're finding that the equatorial belt looks like it goes much, much deeper down. So there's that particular belt along the equator of Jupiter is very, very deep. But elsewhere, the atmosphere penetrating radar that they're using is not finding that the features extend that deep down. There are other features that they're becoming. So there's a lot to discover. I mean, this is one of the sort of humbling things that happens when you send out new instruments and a new mission to a planet that you thought you knew a few things about. You discover that there's a whole lot of stuff that you don't know. And that's one of the things that came out in this recent science press conference that was given. So I'd urge you to have a look at that and listen to it if you want to find out more. The auroras themselves, very plentiful, incredibly powerful, but behave differently to those on Earth. Both poles of Jupiter are covered with Earth-sized storms, densely clustered and actually rubbing up against each other. So that was unexpected as well. The poles look quite different from each other. The north to the south are quite different. They don't understand why. They want to explain why, but they don't know yet. Just moving on with the news, if you're interested in archaeology, and if you're into, in particular, Angkor Wat, that amazing temple complex in the north of Cambodia near Siem Reap, There's a great way of visualizing that on at the moment. It's at Monash University's division called SensiLab. It allows you to look at amazing recreations of what Angkor Wat was like during its heyday back in the 11th century,
right,
when they had thousands of people there working and building this enormous temple complex. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's the biggest religious temple complex in the world.
Yep.
It's not just Angkor Wat. There's actually Angkor Thom. There's other areas which are less well known, mm-hmm, perhaps a little bit more buried or hidden or not as intact, mm-hmm, as the main Angkor complex. But nevertheless, they're there. And so if you've got the time, you know, it's well worth exploring beyond just Angkor Wat. This SensiLab Visualizing Angkor project lets you look at the scenes of what it was like, how they mastered water. So one of the key things that was required to build Angkor Wat was to be able to feed the big working population, yep, to build all those temples. And so that required irrigation. So they had a very sophisticated network of irrigation channels that were allowing them to grow food to feed this army of workers. Apparently, the reason for the decline of the Angkor civilization was that they lost that mastery of water somehow.
Oh, right.
But, you know, it took a while for that to happen. You know, they were there for a long time building those temples and then living and working in them and worshipping in them. So just a really good way of visualizing Angkor if you're interested in a bit of archaeology, or if you have happened to have been to Cambodia, or if you're planning to go.
I'm actually looking at going there later this year. So maybe I'll be doing a trip and seeing there. So maybe I should do both of these 3D visuals to see what it's like, and then actually go to the place and see how they match up.
I'm going to try to get in there and have, mm-hmm, a look at this, because I think it'd be fascinating.
Does it say how long the experience goes for?
What they've done is they've used LIDAR, which is like a laser radar and ground penetrating radar, to actually work out what the original layout was of Angkor. And they've found that it was actually a very advanced society with waterways, extensive irrigation, intensive farming, and substantial wooden housing. The wooden housing is no longer there, mm-hmm, but they can see that, you know, using LIDAR, they can actually see where it was.
Yep.
It's a really good way of visualizing and getting a feel of what it was like there on a big screen, if it's in an auditorium where you look at it on a big screen. So really good.
So are you putting the headset on as well to immerse yourself?
No, this is not VR. No, there may be a VR version of it available at some point, but no, this is just a, you know, this is like a big screen which gives you this rendering of what it would have been like.
Right, okay.
So it's kind of, you know, using accurate information. They've been over there. The people who've put this together, I think for several years now, have been documenting Angkor and that, mm-hmm, the related temples, and putting together very accurate 3D renders, yep, of, and then, you know, extrapolating out from what's there to what would have been there, and allowing you to visualize the place as it was originally. Just another story in the news, Bigelow's inflatable ISS module that they've had up at the International Space Station. It is, as the name suggests, an inflatable module which can have human habitation. That's the idea. Mm-hmm. That's passed its first milestone of tests, where they've basically found that it stood up for the last year that it's been up there. It's copped a few blows from micrometeorites. That's what happens up there. There's bits of debris flying around. There's stuff from outside beyond Earth's orbit that comes flying in. It seems to have stood up to those and hasn't been damaged. It's remained safe for human occupation, so it's leak-proof. But one thing that they're looking at over the next year is just to test how radiation-proof the module is, because it doesn't have the metallic skin that,
yep,
is designed to protect the astronauts from a lot of cosmic radiation. There's lots of stuff up there that'd be very dangerous if you didn't have some protection built into the International Space Station. Well, Bigelow reckons that their skin could actually be even safer than the International Space Station's metallic skin,
right,
even though it's inflatable. It could be used on the Deep Space Gateway, which we've covered in the program, mm-hmm, and the benefit of it is that because it's lightweight, it's compact, you send it up in deflated form, you get it to where you want it to be, and then you inflate it and you wind up with a, you know, something which is much larger than what you launched.
Yeah.
So there are
the payload, basically, it's, you know, it's lighter to get up, and therefore you can, you know, maybe send a bigger space to go up and live in, essentially.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it's got a lot of benefits. That's why they're testing it on the ISS. Seems like in the last year it's passed some milestones. In the next year, they'll be looking at how it responds to radiation. And just one more story from me before I pass over to John. If you're selling your house, you know that the deal is, you know, you go through an agent, and the agent lists the property and handles the marketing for you, and then probably does an auction, mm-hmm, or sometimes a private sale. That's the way that we do it in Australia. Well, there's a company over in America that reckons that the real estate industry is ripe for disruption.
Mm-hmm.
Think of Uber, think of Airbnb, kind of classic examples, yep, of disrupting technologies. The Open Door is an online application to sell your house. Mm-hmm. You can do it through a website and a browser, or you can actually download an app, and it allows various advantages, very quick turnaround. So you know, you can submit your property for sale to opendoor.com. they will use a combination of sort of human calculations and algorithms,
yep.
looking at recent sale prices and market conditions and so on in your area to work out a fair market value and send you an offer within 24 hours usually of receiving your application. The advantages that they tout on their website is that there's no need to keep your house clean and tidy, and you don't have that stressful period of weeks or even months where you're waiting for your property to sell. You've got to have the place clean all the time for inspections and agents coming through with prospective buyers, that sort of stuff. Because it's done through this service that turns it around in 24 hours, you avoid all that. You do actually have human contact. An open door team member, a so-called experience manager, looks over the details of what the algorithm has come up with for the value of your property and then contacts you, the vendor. Mm-hmm. So you do have obviously personal contact in that. They sort of aiming to cover the middle highest volume part of the property market. So in America, properties that are valued between $125,000 and $500,000, a little bit different to Australia and their median prices over there. But it's a much bigger country and there's a much bigger population. They only sell houses that were built since 1960. They sell site-built houses only, not mobile or kit homes.
Yep.
You know, they're aiming for the sort of broadest part of the market rather than the sort of fringes of the market, either the high end or the low end. So far, the cities that are covered by Open Door are Phoenix, Dallas, and Las Vegas, but they are planning to expand. So if you're over in the States, and we know that a lot of Americans listen to this podcast, Open Door could be a solution for you if you're thinking about selling your house. John, what have you got for us?
Well, I guess also for our American listeners, to have a word, I guess, on credit card security. Recently, Chipotle over there, which is quite a well-known restaurant over in the States, and I think there's a few other locations around the world as well, they suffered a problem with credit card stealing malware, which was at their point of sale. I don't believe they have the tap and go system like what we do. There might be small parts of the country that have bits and pieces of it, but not like the adoption that we have, where you can pull your credit card out, or you can pull your debit card, or even your phone if you've got the tap and go type system there, and just tap it on the reader and then you're away. Now, because they don't have that, and they're using what would be the sort of the traditional method of payment through a credit card, that was actually able to capture a lot of the data. So credit card information, and basically everything that you really want to know if you're a hacker off that.
Right.
And so between the period of around about March 24th to April 18th, this malware was on there and just gathering all this data. And most of the sites were actually affected by this malware. It is a concern. We talk about Bitcoin every show and the price there.
Mm.
You wouldn't be able to do this with Bitcoin. So that's one thing. You know, you have to authorize a transaction. So I would have to either send you the code or authorize that there. And even if then you had that one-time code, you couldn't then go and reuse that against something else. So that, you know, that tick one for Bitcoin there. Tap and go, we've got that here in Australia, and that seems more secure. It's not, you know, there are faults with the system, like any system can have them.
Mm.
But again, it is more secure than, say, just the random old, just the swipe system that
sure.
Tend to have. So it would be good to see, moving more towards the more secure system. Maybe this is a way that people can look at, say, the blockchain technology and Bitcoin. I mean, I know some banks are looking at that blockchain technology.
Yeah, and you were saying off air that ATMs, it's now more secure to tap. You know, they're offering to use the chip in your phone using near-field communication between the ATM machine, the hole in the wall and your card, rather than you physically putting it into the slot, and then you run the risk of there being a skimmer attached to the slot which can read your card and store your data.
Do a bit of a wiggle on the way you put the card in on any ATM that you do. Just make it a habit, because it is common. It happens quite a lot. It's a very small device. It's just stuck on there very easily. And with that scanning, your card information.
I've heard it happening on the Mornington Peninsula recently.
Yes.
So this happens. Yeah. They wait for a busy weekend when people are down from Melbourne, when they put one on the machine. It'll usually be one that's open to the open air rather than inside the foyer of a bank or whatever. And people get caught out. And then it can take a while before your card gets reinstated, before you're sort of back able to access money. So it can really be a hassle, particularly if you've just started a holiday. They are recommending, actually, for people who go to big hotels and use open Wi-Fi networks, which a lot of
like
people
airports
do.
Airports and things like
airports
that.
Airports and hotel and hotel chains, that the hotel chain itself may have been
compromised
or you know, through a phishing email that's been sent to an employee. They've got in there, they've got into their database, and they're able to suck down information, and that can really ruin your whole holiday. And we were joking before about, you know, having these, you know, people can go on these digital free holidays where you leave your phone, leave your laptop and your iPad or your tablet behind, because then you don't make yourself vulnerable.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, put the thing in airport mode. Yeah. And they recommend not using things like banking apps or accessing your online banking through a browser when you're in a big hotel or when you're in a Wi-Fi network, open Wi-Fi network.
A VPN might help, but you're still going through the point. So if you're connecting in the Wi-Fi to the hotel, you're still going through that modem there. So it may help, but I wouldn't necessarily put all my trust in it. Mm. The best thing might be to do is to get a local SIM card and then use that, make sure there's data involved in that. So you're not going through anybody else's modem. You're actually going direct through the data there. Just be vigilant with how you operate it. You know, don't jump on a public computer and log into your bank account, because it's, you know, you're surely going to, you know, lose all your money if you go down that path. Mm. British Airways copying a bit of flak at the moment, because about 300,000 passengers have been basically stuck at Heathrow. There's been an issue that's been going on the last few days, and this was due to computer system or IT failure systems that didn't know how to restart. And it looks to be this could be possibly due to outsourcing. Mm-hmm. So it appears that British Airways may have outsourced a lot of their, you know, tech support through to India or elsewhere. There were backup systems that were in place. However, the method to restart those systems to get that backup up and running doesn't look like it was acted on properly, or it doesn't look like there was a guide that actually walked people through to do that. On the one hand, they might have saved themselves a lot of money over the last few months or 12 months or a couple of years by outsourcing. But on the other hand, when the system goes down and you don't have the tech team, the correct tech team to fix it, you've got a lot of people displaced. I mean, there's people sleeping at the airport at the moment, so they're not able to get on flights. It doesn't say exactly, you know, what the issue is. It's just that the systems are down, so that could be, you know, they can't process it here. I think even we had at Melbourne Airport last week where there was a system that went down, and it was the passport checking system, which connects to the global system. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is connected, but this is where the security lines were really, really long. It was taking hours to get through. I think people missed their flights.
Wow.
So it's, I guess, a bit of a word of a warning that if you're looking to outsource, that's fine. I mean, it would be good if we could have the jobs local. If you do that locally, that's great. I understand there's a cost component. I have outsourced overseas. And if you're going to do that, there needs to be some fail-safes in place. So you may still retain a specialized tech team that's on central on-demand contract as you need. Mm-hmm. And in a situation like this, if your system went down and your, you know, outsource team couldn't help, then you've got the backup team that should be able to just, you know, turn it back on, walk in. It might get charged a higher fee, but probably worth paying that amount of money and get it fixed straight away than not paying any money and then not having any systems working and losing the goodwill and customers.
We've got a couple of podcasts about outsourcing with Elance.
Yes.
Which you talked about on our website, beyondinfinity.com.au, if you're interested in learning about the process of outsourcing.
Yep.
And one of the main providers of that, which is Elance.
Yeah, yeah. And just finally from me, before we finish up the news, Australia, it's looking like, according to the eSafety Commissioner, we're about 10 years behind in the cyberbullying arms race. Hmm. I think that's being optimistic. We're probably a lot further behind than 10 years.
Hmm.
So this is where cyberbullying
Facebook, Twitter.
It's across any digital platform, essentially. Hmm. It can happen. Hmm. If it's Facebook, someone might send you a personal message, and it could be that you're connecting with a new person and they seem nice to start with, but then it goes down a very dark path. It could be that they've somehow gained access to your phone number and they're sending you text messages. It could be Snapchat. And this is the sort of thing where on one hand, some people say, oh, it's fine, just ignore it. But there are people that are going through very difficult times where they cannot get away from it, whether it happens on the schoolyard or it's then continued on in the digital space.
Mm.
It is concerning. Mm. The laws that we have, I believe they're working on that to update them, but they're nowhere near where they need to be. Mm. It looks like there's been at least a 60% increase in cyberbullying cases over the past year. And this is according to Julie Inman Grant, who's the eSafety Commissioner. Her office has resolved about 400 complaints in the past 2 years. Now, that number seems pretty low, so I imagine there's a lot of people that are not reporting these cases. If you are going through this, then put your hand up and get some help, because there are plenty of organisations that can help, and maybe head to the eSafety Commissioner's site to begin with. Just do a search. We'll have some links on the show notes as well. It does require the government to basically stand up more. I mean, we're hearing about the revenge porn type scenarios. Yeah,
legislation finally coming to stop there.
But it's more than just that. It's harassment for harassment's sake. There's trolling going online. Mm. We are behind at the moment. Problem is, with tech moving so fast and new
hard
platforms,
to keep up with it.
Yeah, we might get to 5 years behind, but we're still behind. So it's a concern. We'll keep an eye on this. I'm an absolute lover of tech, and I support and promote tech, but we also need to have that balance. You need to feel safe in that environment.
And understand the vulnerabilities of it, absolutely. Thanks for listening.
And head to beyondinfinity.com.au for the best bits from the live show or to connect with us on social media. We welcome your feedback and suggestion for future shows.